Oh my goodness me, we're doing this professionally.
I know.
God, the pressure is on.
I know.
The heat is on, it's on the street.
So start out, I never did get an explanation of how you found out that you were being paroled.
On the afternoon of Monday, November 25th, I was sitting in the pod, the day room in Buckingham Correctional Center, talking on the phone with a friend of mine. An officer comes in and tells me I need to go to the watch office right now. And there's only two reasons for that. Either you've got a charge or you're making parole. So I followed him to the watch office. It was 10 after 4 when I got there. They had me wait in this little vestibule area for 20 minutes, and I actually had the shakes out there. I got the shakes. The warden got me from the vestibule and led me around the corner down a hallway to a conference room. Parole board chairperson Adrian Bennett was there, and parole board investigator Trudy Harris was there. They told me that they were granting me parole, but that I would not get a pardon. And they gave me parole conditions. I have to be deported, I can have no contact with the victim's family, and I can never come back. My first reaction was disappointment, because after this very, very long wait, more than 3 years since the pardon petition was filed, I had really hoped and expected to get a pardon. So the only one in the room who was actually just smiling and really, really happy was the warden, who's a really good guy, actually. And over the last couple of years, when he saw me kind of with my head down because it was taking so long, he would make a point of saying a few words to me. But when I was getting my property out of the pod, you know, everybody was high-fiving me. And even a guy who really disliked me a lot high-fived me, and he was clearly happy. So that was nice. You know, guards, officers along the way, correctional officers along the way, a lot of them said some really nice things to me. And then very early the next morning, they took me back to property to change clothes for the trip. And again, the warden was there, which was so nice of him. It just goes to show that there are people working for the Department of Corrections who are human beings and who do a difficult job but haven't lost their soul and still have a heart. The ICE van from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement was there with two ICE officers. They took the Virginia DOC handcuffs and leg irons off me and put the federal handcuffs and leg irons on me. And it was just an amazing feeling. We backed out of the Sally Port and we were clear of the DOC. And then we drove away and the van had big, big windows. This was the first time I'd been outside of Buckingham Correctional Center since I'd gotten there 10 years earlier. So it's the first time I could see the prison from the outside. That's when it really hit me. I'm physically still in Virginia, but I'm out of Virginia custody. Virginia no longer has me. The feds have me. I'm out of there. And that was an amazing feeling. I was almost 4 years British custody and over 29 years in Virginia custody. 33 years, 6 months, 25 days. And I expect to be leaving any day. But this is not a prison. This is a detention center. The staff treat you much nicer. The food is better, although it's very little, but the food is better. And the people I'm with are not criminals. Most of the people I'm with are really just regular working people who had jobs and American families, but no citizenship. And then they get caught by the police just being drunk. A lot of them just were drunk on a Friday night, get arrested. Then they find out that these folks do not have citizenship. So instead of getting released the next morning like a regular person who has too much to drink, they'd get turned over to ICE. I would say 75% of the people here are from El Salvador. There are some people from Honduras and a couple from Cuba. There's a guy from Bolivia, a guy from the Dominican Republic, four guys from Jamaica. I'm in a pod. It's not cells like Buckingham. It's a dormitory with 22 bunk beds, 44 men, and it's very relaxed. And everybody's really friendly. And unlike prison, you can leave your locker unlocked and nobody takes your stuff. No violence. The really funny thing is I've got nobody to talk to. All the conversations are in Spanish and I have no idea what anybody's saying.
Well, at least you don't need language skills to work out. And you told me you've been spending a lot of time in the gym and you made a big discovery there.
In 1991, I was very nearly raped. And one of the ways I reacted to that was that I started working out like a maniac and running like a maniac. So for the last 28 years, I've been, as they say, busting irons and running laps on prison rec yards. It's what I really enjoy doing. But all they've got is a track and iron weights. So here at the Federal Detention Center, they have a gym, which is really nice, and they've got these really nice elliptical machines. I'd seen those on TV. It was only like on the third time I went to the gym that I finally worked up the courage to try out one of these ellipticals, and I love it. Oh my God, I gotta get one. When I was arrested in 1986, ellipticals had not yet been invented. You know, people ask me, what's it gonna be like using a cell phone for the first time, or using the internet for the first time, or going to a united Germany for the first time, because my country was split when I got arrested. And those are all big things, but it's even little things like an elliptical that I have never experienced. But judging by my response to the elliptical, I'm gonna have a blast. I'm in great health because I've worked at it. So I feel physically really strong and well. I have been at war for more than 33 years. Unlike 99.9% of the prisoners that I've did time with, I did not lay back, play cards, smoke dope, and get a boyfriend. I've been working my tail off to get out of prison for more than 3 decades. Initially, they were trying to execute me for the first 3 years. I had very, very little hope, and it took so much willpower and so much effort to just keep going. In the summer of 2009, I gave up, and I had a very good friend back then who has in the meantime died, Deacon Tom Elliott. He kept me going for those 3 months. He asked me to trust him. I had nothing else left to trust in. I had, by that point, really big problems with my faith in God, and I could see no way forward, and all that was left for me was Deacon Tom asking me to trust him. And I did. And then at the end of those 3 months, I received the DNA tests in the mail, and that then gave me something to fight with, and that gave me hope again. I received the DNA tests at the end of September. I think it was September 26, 2009. And then it took another 10 years and a couple of months till November 25th, 2019 to finally get out. So you asked me how I feel. On some level, of course, exhausted. On another level, I'm very, very happy because now I've achieved what I fought for. But that takes its toll. You know, there are studies that suggest that any prisoner after 10 years in prison has PTSD. It's called chronic PTSD. It's not one single incident. It's a collection of smaller incidents that one finds no relief from. So I'm very fortunate. When I'm going back to Germany, I'm going to be living with a family that have taken me in, just great people. And one of the things they've set up for me is that I already have a psychiatrist over there who is trained in trauma and PTSD, whom I can see anytime I want to. I don't want to stretch the metaphor with war too far, but it's not that different. Some of my best friends in prison were veterans, and they tell me that they see similarities between the two experiences, and sometimes the difficulties only begin once one has returned home from war. I've been reading military history throughout my entire term of incarceration, just because surviving in the penitentiary is like battle. You know, war famously is 95% nothing happens, you're just in terror, and then 5% of the time it's extreme violence. And that's exactly your experience in prison. 95% of the time you're very tense because you're waiting for something to happen, and then for 5% of the time something actually is happening. I have seen many friends die. In my one pod at Buckingham, just in the last year, I think 4 people died. And that's just one pod out of 18 pods at Buckingham.
What was that about?
Drug overdoses and suicide. I've actually watched somebody get raped. I came back from breakfast one time and my cellmate had hung himself from my bunk. I've seen guys die of illness. I've seen guys die of overdoses. I've seen guys nearly die from violence. They got very badly hurt. That's why I also read military history. There's ancient Greek military history called Anabasis, and it's about Greek mercenaries who invade Persia, lose a battle, and then they have to fight their way back to the Greek colonies on the Black Sea. And they have all kinds of adventures. It's horrible, and it's very difficult. And this is an old, old book. This is, I think, 2,500 years old. And then they reach the sea, and they know now, when they see that, when they've reached the sea, now they're within sight of the Greek colonies, and now they're safe, they're home. they see the sea and they call it Talata, Talata, the sea. The sea. Because they're home. And that's what I've been fighting for.
So you're finally going home to a family you haven't actually met. How did they find you?
Like many people in Germany, they've seen my case on television and read about it in articles and read about it in my book. And I've got a great circle of supporters in Germany, and they're a member. They have not visited me yet. Some of my supporters in Germany have visited me, but they have not. But these last 2 years, I have been able to phone Germany. So I've been able to spend a lot of time on the phone. The daughter was actually doing her thesis, her university thesis, on how crime is portrayed in American media. And of course, when you've got a German whose crime is being portrayed in the American media, it's a natural thing for her to be interested in. And that's how I got connected with these folks. The father is a medical doctor and has his own medical institute. He's well known in medical circles in Germany. And I'm just very fortunate. They're great people.
And I gather you'll get back to Germany and then you're going to be leaving again?
The media interest in my case over there is so intense that when I arrive at the airport, they're expecting there to be dozens and dozens of reporters, and they've actually, the Frankfurt airport has set up a conference room where I'm going to be brought, and then I'm going to say like three sentences, and then I'm going to be escorted out the back. And the best thing for me to do at that stage is to greet and celebrate with my very closest supporters, about four of them, and then get on a plane and get out of the country for 2 to 3 weeks and let things die down a little bit, and then come back at the beginning to the middle of January, and then face the press, but first spend some time away from the madness so that I can adjust to reality. Because one of the things I'm gonna have to start learning how to do is how to open a door by myself instead of waiting for somebody to unlock it for me. And it'll also give me a chance to spend a family Christmas with this family that's taking me in. They always go abroad for Christmas. They're thankfully well-to-do. And I'm invited in, and so I get to spend a family Christmas right after I arrive. It's going to be really, really nice. Germany this time of year is cold and rainy, and it'll be nice for me to be someplace warm with people who care about me. This is going to be the biggest transition of my life, one shock at a time.
Do you ever expect to come back to Virginia?
Only if I want to go to prison. That's one of the parole conditions. If I ever come back, I'm going to go to prison.
And you're not allowed to talk to Elizabeth?
No, she's a member of the victim's family, ironically, and I have no desire to speak to that person.
Do you have any relatives left in Germany?
I have a father and a brother with whom I do not want any contact because they broke off contact with me in 2001. I inherited money from my maternal grandmother, and I entrusted that money to my father, and then the two of them decided that it was theirs now, and they cut me off. I was stupid enough to trust my own father, and that was the second time in my life that I trusted the wrong person. The first time was Elizabeth Haysom, and the second time was my father and brother. And since 2001, I've made three attempts to reach out to them, and all three were rebuffed, and I have no desire to have any contact with those people unless they bring me the money back. They've had use of $500,000 of mine. That's what I inherited for 18 years now.
Is there still a chance you'll be pardoned by the governor?
When the parole board chairperson and the parole board investigator told me in that room that they were granting me parole but that I would not get a pardon, my first reaction was disappointment because I did not kill Derek and Nancy Haysom and I deserve a pardon. I was disappointed. Upon reflection over the next couple of days, I came to realize that the way they did this was the only way to get me out of prison politically. I'm still disappointed I didn't get a pardon, but I now see that nothing else was possible. If one looks at the politics of this, if they had granted me a pardon, the governor would have had the victim's family on TV complaining. Something similar applies to the Bedford County Sheriff's Department. If they had granted me a pardon, then that would have been a major slap in the face to the Bedford County Sheriff's Department, and then the governor would have also had the Sheriff's Department on TV complaining about pardoning me. By paroling me, at least nobody's telling them the truth, which is that they screwed up this case, and they can save the little tattered remnants of their honor, shabby as it is. I've been told that the so-called lead investigator on this case, Ricky Gardner, has given interviews to local TV in Roanoke and Lynchburg, saying that the decision not to grant me a pardon at this point vindicates his work on this case, and it's proved that he was right all along, which is malarkey, to put it really politely, but it's also politically necessary to get me out of the country. So I understand. Doing it this way, there was no firestorm, and the governor's fingerprints are not on this decision. You know, he can say my parole board did it. Okay. So this was smart. I want to thank the governor for arranging this, because clearly this was very well thought out. But I also want to take this opportunity to ask him, there's 2 years left in his term of office. 2 years from now, I hope he'll reconsider and grant me pardon right before he leaves office, after all the controversy here has died down and nobody cares anymore. That would be the just decision, because I did not kill Derek and Nancy Hazem. It's a fact that the state of Virginia stole 33 and a half years of my life. And I say stole because we now know it was done knowingly. That's why the FBI profile is so important. Right after the crime was discovered, Bedford County Sheriff Carl Wells brought in the FBI profiler, Ed Sulzbach, who actually helped co-invent the whole science of profiling. And he did a profile of this crime scene. And he found that this was committed by a white female in a close relationship to the victims. I'm not female, and I only met the victims once for about 30 minutes. In the movie, Killing for Love, Ed Sulzbach, the FBI profiler, gave an interview, and he went even further. He said that he told the Bedford County Sheriff's Department, I settled on the daughter, Elizabeth Hazem. They knew all this in 1985. A year later, I'm arrested, and I give a false confession. I tell them I did it. They already had the profile at this point, and that's the point of the profile. When I told them that I'd done it, they knew it wasn't true. But they never challenged me on my statement, my claim, my lie that I did it. And they should have. When I said I did it, a real police officer would have said, well, you know, you sure you want to say that? Because, you know, we have pretty strong indications that that's not actually true. But that's not what Ricky Gardner did. Ricky Gardner wrote it down and hung me with it. I gave my statement, my lie, my false confession, on June 8, 1986. And 5 days later, on June 13, 1986, I was indicted for capital murder. There was no investigation to check whether my confession was actually true. We only found out about the FBI profile decades later, just a few years ago. And Ricky Gardner still denies that the profile exists, even though Ed Sulzbach, the profiler, is in the movie Killing for Love, saying definitely it exists, and even though FBI agent Stanley Lapikus obtained the original FBI file and in April 2018 held a press conference at which he said directly that in his opinion, Ricky Gardner is not telling the truth, he's lying. That's one cop publicly saying that another cop lied. That is so damn rare. It's unheard of. But it's based on the fact that Stanley Lapikus, the FBI agent, obtained the file and saw what's in the file, and he showed it to the public. There was a profile. The file does not contain the actual profile, but it shows that it was created, and it shows the conclusions. So that's why I say Virginia stole these years, because it was done knowingly. This wasn't an accident. And the reason why Ricky Gardner continues to deny it to this day is also in the movie, because in the movie, he says it. If there had been a profile, it would have been exculpatory evidence. He knows what he did wrong. This is not Ralph Northam's fault, the governor's fault. This is not the parole board's fault. This is nobody's fault. It's not even the current sheriff's fault. The only ones who are at fault here are Ricky Gardner and Jim Updike, who unfortunately now is a judge in Bedford County. Heaven help the poor sons of guns who've been tried in front of this individual, because as prosecutor, he was right in the thick of suppressing that evidence.
How did you know the details provided in the confession?
Elizabeth killed her parents on the evening of March 30th, 1985. In the very early morning hours of March 31st, 1985, she returned to where I had been. I had stayed in Washington, D.C. in a hotel. She returned and told me she'd killed her parents. She said the drugs made her do it. She said they deserved it anyway, which was a reference to her allegation that her mother had sexually abused her with her father's knowledge. And then she said, if you don't, you have to be my alibi, you have to help me or they'll fry me. And then I listened to this and I told her, look, I can't be your alibi, they'll never believe me. They never believe boyfriends and husbands and stuff like that. So that's not gonna work, I can't be your alibi. And then I sort of had this idea that I would take the rap for her because I thought my father's status as a German diplomat would protect me. And this was based on Charles Dickens' novel, A Tale of Two Cities, where Sidney Carton, one of the characters in the novel, volunteers to go to the guillotine for a crime he didn't commit in order to save the woman he loved. And that's what I wanted to do for Elizabeth, to save her life. Except I would not be guillotined. I thought I was protected by my father's status as a diplomat. Once we had settled on that decision, we spent the rest of that night practicing what I would tell the police, because we both thought that the police would come in at any minute. So we spent, you know, 3-4 hours just rehearsing. But then the police never talked to me, and we left the country, went on the run, and then it was more than a year later, I think it was like 14 months after that night, that I finally gave the false confession. And even though I got a lot right, a lot of details were correct because Elizabeth had supplied them to me, so much time had passed that I also got a lot of details wrong.
How did she explain to you that she could possibly have killed two people with a knife?
She didn't explain that. She said it, and I believed her. She was clearly in shock. If somebody tells you that they've killed two people, you know, you kind of believe it. And I was in shock myself. It didn't occur to me to challenge her. I mean, I was 18. I didn't know how to kill people. I mean, or how that what that was supposed to look like. I just didn't think about it. She said she did it. I believed her. And it turns out, and I didn't know this until years later, that she had at least two people helping her. And that's based on the DNA evidence. There's nothing forensic linking me to that crime scene at all. No shoe prints, no blood, no fingerprints, no hair, nothing. But there is DNA evidence of two other men at that crime scene. And Elizabeth, of course, the shoe print is her size, her blood type is at the crime scene, her fingerprint is at the crime scene. So what the forensic evidence says is that she did this with two men. And if you ignore all the blah, blah, all the statements and all the different things different people said, if you look just at the forensics, this is a really simple case.
You've actually written a couple of books about your case. Would you expect now to make a living as an author?
The week before I received parole, I, for the first time, self-published a book on Amazon, Kindle Direct. It's my first novel, The Son of the Promise. It's a courtroom drama in the style of John Grisham. And so that's one possibility. Of course, I had, prior to that, 6 books published, but they're all nonfiction books. The last one is the one about my case. The 6th book is called A Far, Far Better Thing. I did that with Bill Sizemore, who's a Pulitzer-nominated reporter from Virginia Beach. And if you want the long version of the story, that's the one to get. My agent in Germany tells me I've already had several book offers over there. There's some interest in making made-for-TV movies. I've got an agent for public speaking in Germany. The public speaking industry is surprisingly large. There's great demand. Mostly it's former politicians and former sports stars, and they want something different. And I'm definitely different. And what they want is stories of resilience, coming through struggle and winning out in the end. And that is what my life has been about. To give you an example, a few years ago, there was a man out west who went hiking and got trapped. His arm was trapped by a rock, and he had to saw off his own arm, and Clint Eastwood made a movie about it. Well, that guy is on the speaking circuit here in the United States and is hugely successful. And my story obviously has a lot of parallels to that. I didn't saw off my own arm, but I threw away 33 years of my life, and I got away just like the guy who had to saw off his own arm. I know in Germany, the idea that somebody like me could survive 33 and a half years in the American prison system without being broken. People find that intriguing. That's number one. Number two, anybody with a little bit of a sense of idealism and romance can sympathize with the idea of being so much in love that you're willing to sacrifice yourself for that person. And I actually did that. That makes me, I think, intriguing and possibly a figure of hope for people. And I think people perhaps imagine or question, if I were in that situation, would I do that? Would I be willing to lay down my life for somebody? The third thing is, I think people in Germany understand DNA, so they understand that this was an enormous injustice. Making somebody spend 33 years in prison for something that clearly he didn't do, it's just outrageous. There were many points along the way where this could have been corrected, but the system failed again and again and again and again, and it took 33 years to finally win. And then the fourth thing is, and this is unfortunate, this feeds a certain anti-American narrative in Germany, which I'm going to counteract because I like America. This feels like home to me. I only spent 3 years in Germany. I spent my entire adult life here. As I like to say, using your idiom, all y'all are batshit crazy, but you're my kind of crazy, and I kind of like you. And it's Americans that got me out of prison. There were four bad apples who put me in prison. Judge Bill Sweeney, Prosecutor Jim Updike, Ricky Gardner, the cop, and then, of course, Elizabeth Hazen. And she's a Canadian, so y'all don't even have to take the rap for her. And then all the many, many, many Americans who fought so hard to get me out of prison. Steve Rosenfield, my great and fantastic lawyer. Steve Northup, another great lawyer. Gail Marshall and Gail Ball, my former lawyers. People like Deacon Tom Elliott and Reverend Richard Bush and Bishop Walter Sullivan, who kept my head above water when I was nearly drowning. Reverend Beverly Cosby, another one. So many of them. All the cops that have come around to support me. Chip Harding, Richard Hudson, Stan Lapikus, Chuck Reed. Some cops who have supported me behind the scenes who I cannot name here on the radio. People like Martin Sheen and John Grisham and Jason Flom. Moses Shanefield and Tom McClintock. The list goes on and on and on. They're all Americans, and they all fought really hard to get me out of prison. So I'm not mad at America, and I'm not mad at Americans. You know, I'm mad at three Americans and one Canadian. That's it.
So I assume that your finances are set, that you won't have any problem with money?
These opportunities in Germany have not yet been realized. And fact is that the media industry is going broke. So there's not a lot of money in this, any of this. And because I was released by parole, not by pardon, Virginia will not compensate me. And I think that's actually one of the reasons why they did it. Virginia would have had to pay me $1.4 million. And that's not automatic. The General Assembly has to vote to give me the $1.4 million. Now, you imagine the Virginia General Assembly voting to give a foreigner $1.4 million. That would have led to another firestorm, which is, again, another reason why I think they chose parole instead of pardon. So I'm not going to get compensated. I'm going to have to fend for myself. There is a button on my website where people can donate. I'm going to need financial help. I'm coming out to nothing.
Do you plan to keep in touch with any of the guys that you met in prison here?
To be really honest about that, I think I really, for my own mental health, I'm going to have to leave that behind. You folks out there don't know and can't understand how hard prison life is, what a hell it's become. It's always been a hell, but it's really, really bad. It's so much worse than you can imagine. And now that I'm out of it and I'm in this halfway civilized detention facility here, just the thought of looking, you know, like Lot's wife, right? Looking over my shoulder, looking back at that nightmare back there. I don't think I can do it.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about your case? Anything else that hasn't already been said?
I want to apologize to the victim's family. This means something to me. It's important for me to say this. I did not kill Derek and Nancy Hazen, but in 1985, I kept silent when I should have spoken out. I withheld the truth. And then in 1986, I lied. And as a result of that, the victim's family was denied the truth about what happened to Derek and Nancy. And that caused them more than three decades worth of suffering. on top of the loss of their parents. And it was unnecessary. I should have told the truth, and I did not. And I hurt them by doing that. And I am very sorry for that.
Any words or thoughts for Elizabeth Haysom?
Well, I saved her life. I'm sure she would have been executed, but for me. And honestly, I think the only reason she's getting out of jail is because I've been kicking up a fuss for 3 decades. I think there's high likelihood, given the high-profile nature of the original crime, that Elizabeth and I would have stayed in prison until we died, except for me kicking up a fuss for all these decades. And that brings me to this interesting little thing about the way this whole decision was arrived at. In January of this year, I was denied parole for the 14th time. And then in November of this year, just 10 months later, I'm granted parole on my 15th attempt. And the only thing that changed in between is that they had the midterm elections.
So you come out of prison with a unique story, one that may interest lots of people. What's the essence of that story? What's the message you have for an audience?
I see my life as a long struggle towards victory that I've now achieved. This is not the life I would have chosen for myself, but it's the life I had, and I'm okay with my life. I fought honorably, and I won. I never lost my honor, and I didn't take anybody's honor. I've met wonderful people along the way. This was a very, very, very difficult thing to do, and I did it successfully. And, you know, what would the alternative have been for me? You know, I could have become a hedge fund manager and be filthy rich now. Well, there's a whole lot of filthy rich hedge fund managers, and, you know, there's only one of me.
So you come out of prison with a unique story, one that may interest lots of people. What's the essence of that story? What's the message you have for an audience?
The idea is to move forward and embrace whatever it is that's coming at you. The natural human tendency is to withdraw into a shell, and that does not work. You know, then there are other things like avoiding the issue by doing things like drinking, drugs, gambling, things like that. That doesn't work either, right? The only thing that actually works is moving forward and embracing whatever it is that's coming at you. And it was kind of forced on me at the very beginning of my incarceration when I was facing the death penalty. And I was sitting in London, in prison, and everybody, including my own lawyers, were telling me, you have no chance. All we're doing here is we're extending your life a little bit. You have no chance of escaping execution. Because up until my case, people were getting sent back to America and executed. And they told me Jim Updike has never lost one of these cases. Every capital murder case he's ever had, he's won, and it's ended in execution, and you're going to die. And then they sent me these legal briefs they were filing in which they were trying to show the courts that I should not be sent back because electrocution was such a horrible way to die. I had very little else to read, so I read these descriptions of electrocutions gone wrong, you know, with eyeballs popping out and biting off the tongue and the hair on your arms catching on fire and having to be given like 3 jolts of electricity over the space of half an hour to actually kill you. And this is what I was reading for 3 years, and I couldn't get away from it, and I had to face my own death for 3 years at the age of 19 until 21. That's all I had, locked in a stone room with my own death. And, you know, I kept a rope made out of bed sheets under my mattress so I could always hang myself if I needed to, because my only hope at that point was to deny Virginia the pleasure of executing me. That was the only future I saw for myself. If there's a court decision that goes against me, before they send me back to America, quick, let me hang myself, because once I get into America, they're not going to give me a chance to hang myself. So I had to hang myself over in England, and so I had to have the rope under my bed. One of the things I came away with from that experience is not avoiding the problem, facing it, embracing it, dealing with it. Then the other thing that I think is just really, really crucial is the support, the love I've been shown by people on the outside. The longer I've been doing this, the more I realize how important that has been. This started, again, in 1986 in England with this vice consul at the German embassy there called Waltraud Sefte, who visited me once or twice a week and never failed, never let me down. And she always cared about me, and she always talked to me, and she was always there for me. And over the next 33 years, I've never been without really, really good friends on the outside who visited me and who loved me.
And it's a long line. It's a long, long line. Sometimes the only thing that kept me going is that I couldn't face the thought, I couldn't disappoint the people who believed in me, who trusted in me. And letting them down sometimes was the only reason I had to keep going. Because if it had just been for myself, no human being can live just for himself, I think. Unless you're a sociopath. I need other human beings, and I have a really strong need to make other human beings happy. It's probably one of the reasons I got into this mess, because I just couldn't bear the thought of Elizabeth suffering. I had to make her happy. I felt I had to make her happy. I felt I had to save her life. I still like making people happy. That's carried me through some really, really, really tough times. Another one of the sort of techniques that I've developed that I'm going to be using in these speeches is this idea, there's this expression of reframing that's used in pop psychology. To give one example, when at the very early 1990s, when I was under grave threat of being raped, because prison rape is so common, I stepped back, I looked at what the problem was. The problem was that I was very low in the pecking order. I was at the very bottom of the pecking order. I had to rise up in the pecking order. How do I do this? I became a loan shark with two other prisoners. And that gave me a position in the prison hierarchy. And the absurd thing is I did this for 5 years, from 1991 to 1996. I did it so that I wouldn't be raped. Quite coincidentally, I ended up making money. For prison circumstances, a good bit of money. And I revolutionized the prison loan sharking industry because it was based on violence. And I convinced these guys I was working with, hey, it's not a good idea to beat up your customers. Let's not do that, right? I introduced them to ideas like cartel formation, credit references, the Pareto principle, and especially customer relations. For our best customers at Christmas, they got little gift bags from a prison loan shark. And we made money doing this. We made more money doing this than beating up our customers, right? Which I wouldn't have been beating them up anyway, but they were the muscle and I was the brains, right? That's frame breaking. You move outside and find what the real problem is and then solve that problem. The first example of that, in a way, okay, was again fighting the death penalty in the first 3 years. Because at that time in Europe, some countries still had the death penalty on the books. They were not using it, but it was still in the law books. So I could not argue at the European court that executing me would violate my human rights. So what my lawyers, this was not my idea, but I understood what they were doing, and it's an example of frame breaking, right? Instead of, they did argue that the method of execution was very cruel, and that's how I got all these reports on horrible electrocutions gone wrong. But the really clever thing was, we can't stop him from being executed because that's on the books. But making him wait for his execution, the so-called death row phenomenon, that's cruel and inhumane. And my lawyers thought, we don't have a chance with this argument. It's never going to work. You're going to die, is what they told me. You know, but they won with that argument. And that was really the first example of frame breaking. Okay, and it wasn't even mine. My lawyers came up with this. It's okay to kill him, but you can't make him wait to kill him. You know, so those are the three things, right? Embracing the problem, frame breaking. And then having a great support team and love both ways. Them loving me, but me also not wanting to disappoint them.